eliminate, but eliminate most of the garbage that I'd pick up at Glen Oaks. The reason why we're doing 2.5 kilohertz is because of the filters in this equipment. And that was actually on 900 megahertz for the commercial world. It was required that it's 2.5 kilohertz, so there you go. I mean, I could yank the filters and make it a little wider, but I don't think so. I think I'm just going to stay with this. It's just going to make it a little better.
Understand. And so if you went to 5 kc of deviation on the input to that link, and the receiver is set for 2.5, you'd be banging into the walls, making square waves, dropping out on the PL tone and whatever. So so you found a piece of equipment, commercial bulletproof equipment, that's not picking up all the local digital noise, but you've got to live with 2.5 kc to do it. I think that's the impression I'm getting, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW.
Swap
them,
Dick.
Yeah, that's what I think you did. Go ahead, Eric.
Now, let's put it this way. If I put 5 in there, we'd be listening to stuff that we don't want to hear because you have no idea how crowded that band is. And it's not all commercial stuff. There's a lot of ISM, and actually there's alarm systems that are in there, and a whole bunch of other things, and a lot of digital crap, so it's been a fight to just kind of keep the junk out, and I'm happy with the frequencies that I picked, because if I move 25 kilohertz up or 25 kilohertz down, it just doesn't work.
I believe you. So you're running between the raindrops. You found a frequency channel, so to speak, which is reasonably quiet of all of that jazz. And we amateurs can push our luck a little bit. I think we could squeeze near the end of the band where almost nobody else wants to go, just as long as we've got a sharp enough filter that we don't go beyond the edge of the band and start interfering with an adjacent service. So I bet you've considered that. But when you look with your bulletproof spectrum analyzer or service monitor, is there a really narrow channel you could choose right at the edge of the band on each edge and get away from some of the stuff? K2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. Well, what the commercial band is, it begins exactly at the end of our space. And by the way, we're in shared space. It's not really our band. We share it. I was lucky enough to find a particular spot that we actually had coordinated. I mean, if I wanted to go outside the coordination and do some other weird thing, yeah, I could probably come up with a better solution, but you know, I want to stay within the ARRL band plan, so that way nobody can point a finger at it and say we're doing something bad. Besides, the FCC has just recently reallocated a lot of the stuff that's in this band, and we're going to wind up losing. They haven't officially taken it away from us, but they gave it to a bunch of other folks that are banging right in there in the middle, and they're there already, so... So I think I got kind of the best of both worlds at the moment.
Away of all of your broadcast transmitter involvement over all the years, Eric, you might have an opinion on this particular subject, and that is the FCC in the last few years has mandated that future commercial two-way audio systems will use 2.5 kc of deviation as opposed to 5. And on paper, I guess Jim Achowski and his crew thought that oh boy, we're going to get twice as many people in here, and we're going to get a lot more customers for the number of megacycles available. On paper, it sounds good. When you look at what's going on with the real sideband amplitudes, the Bessel functions of 2.5 kc versus 5 kc of deviation, you've cut the sideband amplitude down by 6 decibels. So if you were using the exact same receiver, you would take a 6 decibel hit in signal-to-noise ratio. When you redesign the receiver for 2.5, you recover some of that, but you still got less and less audio being converted from the carrier into the sidebands because of the modulation process. In my opinion, this 2.5 kc mandate is a mistake. It's forcing a lot of people to make a lot of changes in equipment. It's going to give lower performance because of the intermodulation distortion that's going to be created by squeezing more people into the same number of megacycles. The overall picture, I think, is going to be almost no gain, and I think there's going to be more loss than gain. That's my opinion, and you being a broadcast engineer might have a different opinion. KE2EJ, KQRIW, and the almost TechNet. You guys heard.
K2RIW, K2EJ, you forget one really important thing. The mandate for 2.5 kilohertz is here now, but also as part of the mandate, it's forcing people to go digital, so they have to throw their crap out in the first place. So, I don't remember when the actual cutover date is, but it's coming up on us fast, and more people are going to digital with the 2.5 kilohertz.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
During the timeout, you came out continuously on 375. I had no trouble hearing you on the input. So, to repeat what Eric said, is that the mandate is here. It's coming up real fast. There's no turning back. People are going over to digital. And now, with 2.5 kc of deviation on a channel and a digital mode, your bit rate is being limited by the 2.5 kc as opposed to 5. So, digitally derived audio on a 2.5 kc channel, as opposed to analog audio on a 2.5 kc channel. I guess by the right kind of packets and forward error correcting and packet repeats because of errors in the packets. If I'm sending audio in a digital manner on a 2.5 kc channel, tell me what you think that's going to be like in the real world with real intermodulation distortion on busy places like where Glen Oaks is located, for instance. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Now, K2RIW, K2EJ. Let me let it recycle. All right, I'm listening to 375. It's quick when you drop it, you get the tone right away, so. I actually didn't put any delay in it. Now, the biggest problem you get with the digital is splatter. And you know what? The digital receiver just ignores it. The worst problem that those folks are going to have is intermittent audio and lack of range at periods of time. But for the most part, they're really not going to notice it. And the good thing is Jankowski is no longer there. The new guy is actually a little bit more reasonable. What he's doing for the broadcasters right now makes a lot more sense than what the last guy did.
Okay, so if the digital makes splatter, which is very unpleasant to listen to if you're on the adjacent channel with an analog audio system, and hopefully the splatter doesn't create huge bit error rates on the digital channel, if the adjacent channel is digital, are we also running into a similar situation we ran into with digital television? A significant percentage of the population feels they have been lied to. When we went over from analog television to digital television, we're going to get all these advantages of a lot more channels of information within the RF bandwidth, and we were promised that we're going to have approximately the same range. Well, a hell of a lot of people think that the range is cut back. With this digital audio 2.5 kc system, are they also going to be losing some of that range? Are they being fibbed to again, possibly, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, well, with digital television, the way the FCC looks at it, they look at it from the point of view that you've got an antenna on your house and it's 30 feet off the ground, which is pretty unrealistic for a lot of folks. But interestingly enough, when you put, say, channel 20 against channel 21 against channel 22, because of the mass filters that they use, you've seen my mass filters. They're huge! And the fact that they're so huge is the roll-off on the edges of the signal have to be, in order to meet FCC specs, you've got to be 55 to 56 dB down. It's amazing that it comes out that way. Because when you look at what's coming out of the transmitter, it's maybe 35 or 40. Without the filters, you get that extra 10 dB. It makes a huge difference. And believe it or not, you don't need the white space. You don't need the guard channel on either side as we did in analog. So it does actually work out better. And by the way, the FCC has allowed folks to increase their power to reach an equivalent grade B as they did with their analog. But, that's fine on paper.
Yeah, some of the really long-range television people used to get were the low VHF channels, 2, 4, 5, and 6. And because the digital system is extremely vulnerable to impulse noise from power lines, ignitions of automobiles and lawn mowers and leaf blowers and edgers, the lower channels, 2 through 6, on digital television are essentially unused in many of the metropolitan areas. Digital television cannot tolerate impulse noise. In the case of analog television, you would see some bars, a white bar, slowly walking through the picture, and it was annoying, but at least you had a picture. With digital, you get nothing. So we've lost lower VHF, where we used to get most of the range. The higher VHF, you get a little bit less range. UHF, the average consumer, gets less range again. But if he's willing to put up a reasonable television aerial on the chimney of the house, he was pretty happy well beyond Smithtown, Nascondset on Long Island, and maybe in many cases with a little bit better installation, he was happy in Southampton, and he was getting New York City television. Once we went over to digital, that all went away. And just by raising the power, I'm not convinced we're going to get that back, Eric, because of multipath vulnerability as well as impulse noise vulnerability, I don't know if that's going to do it. I think we've lost. On top of that, some of the audience has bailed out, although, like you said, some of the people are not liking paying $150 and $200 a month for television, and they're going back to over-the-air broadcast. KE2EJ for any of the above, QRIW and the TechNet.
All right, K2RW, K2J. First of all, there's more than a dozen Channel 2s around the country. So, you know, thinking about New York City and its terrain, there's one particular environment. As you go to other parts of the country, it's a very different environment. But we've had major improvements in receivers. We've also had major improvement in exciters and the way they operate. So those problems are getting less and less. Which is a reality. The other thing is you're still stuck in the Stone Age as far as digital television is what you're using to modulate it with. So your experience is somewhat behind the times at the moment. So and by the way, there's a new ATSC 3.0 that's coming around the corner now that they're still working on, which is going to be interesting. And then of course there's the enhanced VSV, which is for mobile receivers, which actually works while you're moving. But, you know, it is getting better, Dick. It's not like it was 5 years ago. It is considerably better. But the fact that here, where I am, I can even pick up the station in Trenton pretty reliably, so the range is getting better. It ain't quite the way you'd like it to be, but it's almost. So what you considered was an analog grade B, maybe 10 to 15 miles shorter than that, but we're getting close. So it's getting better, and the problems that you describe are getting less. They're still there, but they're not quite nearly as bad.
Okay, there's a couple of people who want to make comments. Mr. Spagnoli, who is arguably one of the guys most responsible for the protocol that we're using for digital television. When he ran a series of experiments before digital television became on-the-air reality, he did demonstrate, and you and I have got a copy of that report, where the lower VHF channels, where impulse noise is more prevalent, that it created more grief. With the Spagnoli demodulator, that was present in that year. I'm going to guess that was the year 2005, 2006, 2008, somewhere in that neighborhood. Anyhow, have the new advanced digital receivers for digital television suddenly become less vulnerable to lower VHF impulse noise? I'm having trouble believing that one, Eric, because the way the Bartez modulation looks when you look with a spectrum analyzer at a modern-day digital television transmitter, I know that that receiver is gulping down that whole 5.9 megacycles simultaneously to try to get all of those bits of information, to get all of those streams of video. There can be as many as 9 streams of video and audio in there. So the noise equivalent bandwidth of that demodulator, in my opinion, is greater than it used to be. Therefore, the impulse noise, which has got a lot of high-frequency components, is still going to be more vulnerable. Are the newer demodulators less impulse noise sensitive? And are we therefore, in some of those metro areas, to go back to using lower VHF channels 2 through 6, KE2EJ, K2LIW?
All right, K2IWK, TJ. Couple things you're forgetting, that one, the number of streams is irrelevant, because the transport stream is what we're talking about here, not the elementary stream that has the individual information in it. Okay, each transport stream has its own error correction associated with its own stream. And by the way, those packets are all jumbled together. They're not necessarily, you know, it's not necessarily spitting out, say, channel 2-1 and 2-2 in order. It might be doing a couple of video packets of 2-1, a couple of video packets of 2-2, and some audio packets of 2-1, some audio packets of 2-2, and guide information and data information and a whole bunch of other stuff. So what we're really talking about is the transport stream, or the thing that carries the whole 19.39 megabits worth of information. And on the RF side, we use something called TELUS, which actually, each symbol could be, we could actually consider a symbol to be 8 bits, but really, the symbols that we get after the TELUS is only 3 bits, and there's groups of them, so. You got a little built-in help on the RF portion of it. Let me interrupt. The folks that are using channel 2, the folks that have big areas to cover, like Texas, you know, flat areas, and they seem to have less of an issue. The new demodulators are much less impervious to impulse noise. They handle it a lot better than they used to. And I mean a lot better than they used to. They're not perfect yet. You know, I don't think it's ever going to be perfect either. Even if we go to COFDM, I don't think that's going to be perfect either. But we've made, you know, oodles of improvements. By the way, Jerry's report was from 1999. It wasn't from 2006, so, you know, this system's quite old. Most people don't realize that they went to work on this system in 1980 when high def first came around. It really didn't get finalized until about 1998, and that became the standard. We were transmitting digital in 2000, just at the beginning of 2000. And then we went up to the World Trade Center in 2001. We were on the air for exactly a month before the Trade Center went bye-bye. So, yeah, it's gotten a lot better, Dick. It really has. And as time goes on, and as we move into the new system, I think it will get even better. So, a lot of people that are, say, west of Jane Hill have a pretty good time with it. And you folks that are a little bit east of Jane Hill have got, you know, a bit of a problem because you're literally sitting in a valley.
By the way, my family, after hearing your comments last week, are giving me quite a bit of pressure that I'm going to be buying a new digital television for the family. And I'm going to be wanting one with a version 6, 9, whatever, with the demodulator, and I'd like picture-in-picture. Those are the things I care about most. I don't care very much about three-dimensional television and using the fancy glasses. My family doesn't go for that. I know that Dennis, NY2HF, among other people, wants to make a comment on what we've heard so far. Dennis, give us as much audio as you can out there in Cutshort. NY2HF, K2RIW, go ahead, Dennis.
Thank you, Dick. What I wanted to say was that you're absolutely right. You know, we have cable here in the house, but we paid about $79 a month because Cablevision listed TV only at 1, so they reduced our bill $79. What I'm trying to say is, you know, for the normal cable customer, you could probably for the amount that people are paying per month for cable. And, so, you know, you got to weigh what's going on. As far as Eric, do you think that terrestrial digital
on 975-375. He sounds quite a bit better tonight than on 85. But the main question he's asking, Eric, is terrestrial digital over-the-air broadcast going to continue? And now that's one of the subjects you gave us some information on last week, that Janachowski was talking from time to time about getting rid of it. Mr. Wheeler, I think, is strongly in favor of keeping over-the-air broadcast. Dennis is mentioning the fact that people have to pay as much as for digital television, for cable television, they're paying as much as they would for the rental of a car. And some of the people are starting to protest. So I'd like to believe, Eric, that you have reason to believe that because of protests of lots of influential people like Dennis, that it's an American right, an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness of over-the-air broadcast television. I want to hear that that is the answer, that broadcast television is never going to go away. It's something that's burned into our genes, and we can't live without it. We're addicted to it. K2EJ, is that the truth? K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, Mr. Wheeler is a smart man, and the auction that was supposed to happen to repack the television band so they could give more of the spectrum away, they want to give away another 120 megahertz, he decided that, whoa, wait a second, because a lot of the things that we were using to make those measurements with, besides, you know, who's going to get what, has been pushed back to 2015 now, so it'll give the folks at the engineering department, the FCC, a little bit more time to come up to speed and look at the reality of things. I think Wheeler, and with pushing from Homeland Security and a few other organizations, broadcast television is sort of like, at least with the way that they're going at it, it's here to stay, because they know damn well that the internet and cable and fiber even goes to heck when you have power outages and problems. So in terms of the national emergency, they're beginning to realize that over-the-air broadcasting is the way to go. The other thing that's working against us is that there's an act of Congress that said we've got to get the 120 megahertz and give it to people who aren't going to use it, you know, like Verizon and AT&T and T-Mobile. Another thing that's happening that also pushed it back is that the little guys, the little phone companies are saying, hey, wait a minute, we deserve some of this spectrum too. You can't just outbid it. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens over the next year or so in terms of where people are going to get squeezed. And the broadcasters themselves have to decide how much money is their space worth. Even though the airwaves belong to the public, and it's not a commercial thing, so, you know, flip a coin, toss the hat, roll the dice, see what you think is going to happen. K2RIW, K2AJ.
We got to make sure we vote out of office any of those people who think they're going to get rid of over-the-air broadcast. We've got to make sure we vote into office. I know that when it comes to FCC chairman, they're not voted into office. I think they're appointed by the president in many cases, or somebody like that. Okay, for those who are wondering what in the world's going on, this is a unusual beginning of the TechNet. Last week we also spent quite a bit of time on this particular subject. Whenever we get into the subject of digital television broadcast, because built into each ham radio operator is a desire to someday work in the broadcast world. When we get onto the subject, as we did 6 months or so ago, John gets 283 emails into his mailbag, people saying, I want to hear more about that. This is, when we get onto the subject, we get a hell of a lot of interest of a lot of people. So we give them extra time, and the normal scheduling of the TechNet gets turned upside down. Eric wanted to make a comment. There was a second person who wanted to make the comment. Who was that other person? K2RIW. My name is Dick. Okay, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there wasn't another person. So this is a late beginning, unusual way that we're beginning the TechNet. This is a gathering of people who just love wireless equipment, and we believe a great educational process is taking place here. That's the reason why for the last 31 years, people gather at this frequency at this time, 146.85 megacycles in the New York City area, tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. They gather and they share information. We teach each other how all this equipment works, how to make it work better.
and what's really going on. At this time, I'm going to take check-ins for people who do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in because you're listening. After 31 years, we believe somebody is listening. That's been proven to us already. If you really got a question or a comment for the TechNet, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW listening.
This is KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey. Name here's Joe, and yes.
Fantastic. Done exactly right, Joe. We got Joe. Next person with a question or a comment. Give me your call letters and name right now.
W-S-2-N.
Okay, we got Paul, WS2N, both with a space report and a real question. And I heard a blank 7 from Nevada who was coming in at the exact same time, and therefore I didn't get completely Mr. Nevada. Blank 7 from Nevada, please give me your full call and name again right now, sir. K2RIW listening.
Okay, Kilo Alpha 7, Zulu Alpha Uniform, name is Arlen, Alpha Romeo Lima Alpha November in Sparks, Nevada.
Very fine, Arlen. KA7ZAU, we got you on the list. Anyone else with a question or a comment for the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name. K2RIW listening.
NY2HF with a question, Dennis.
Okay, we got Dennis. So, Joe, R-Link, Dennis, anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Point of order, Dick.
Go right ahead, John.
When you finish with the check-in list, just leave a long delay for anybody on IRLP or, you know, like that one from Nevada there. Maybe there's somebody else trying to get in, just to remind you.
Good suggestion, John. So, one more call for people who have a question or a comment for the technical net, and I'm going to leave a long enough pause so that people in the outer areas stand a chance of getting through. K2RIW listening.
All right, just one more thing. Just let me read you a list of who's listening to it. We've got a repeater in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, a repeater in Salem, Massachusetts, a repeater in Boston, Massachusetts, a repeater in, Reno, Nevada is the only thing that we've got on IRLP, so. And then should leave the space for Echo and let me see who's there.
Okay, from time to time we have repeaters. I know in the Golden Horseshoe area of Canada, obviously Reno, and we, from time to time we hear of other areas. We're going to give a long enough pause right now for people in the outer areas who want to check in because they do have a question or a comment. Give me your call letters and name right now. We're going to give a long enough pause. K2RIW listening.
Kilo Foxtrot 7, Victor November Hotel. And Reno, Nevada.
Kilo Foxtrot 7, Victor November Hotel. What is your name, sir?
Lance, Lima Alpha November Charlie Echo, L-A-N-C-E, Lance. And you ready for a question?
I'm glad you asked that question, Lance. We're going to go in order. The first person who signed in with a question was Joe, KC2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey. Quebec Yankee, I think it's whiskey, yes. Go right ahead, Joe, with your question. K2RIW.
Hey, Roger, that easy question, easy. My question is, let's say I want to put a tower or up. Do I need... That's my question. Back to the net.
Okay, your signal didn't come through continuously yet.
To put up a tower? That's my question.
Okay. Each individual zoning board of your particular town, hamlet, community, county, whatever, they all set slightly different rules on this, but almost all of them really require a building permit if the tower exceeds a particular height. For many communities, that height is 35 feet. Some of them is 25. Portions of New York City is 75. You only need a permit in, at New York City if you exceed 75, which is amazing to me in the five boroughs. So when you, in almost every community, you can go to your local town hall, go to the building department or the whatever department it's called that handles zoning and housing, and find out what are the rules. In many communities nowadays, like my particular community of Huntington, I can receive a copy of the zoning rules on the internet. Not only that, I can look up the property of each one of my neighbors and find out exactly what taxes they pay, whether that they've got a star advantage as far as tax relief, and what are the rules and regulations. So in many communities, if the tower is under 35 feet, and some guys fox the rules a little bit with that, they put up a crank-up tower, and most of the time during the day it's going to be cranked down below 35 feet, they don't bother applying for a permit. In many communities, hams have exceeded the 35 feet, if that's what the local community requires, and they've gone through the process of getting a building permit. In some communities it's easy, some communities it's hard. It's a function of your particular community and how much respect they have for ham radio after Super Strong Sandy. Let me drop. And some hams have just gone and put up the tower and didn't worry about the permit. I'm not recommending that, but some people have done it. And as long as your neighbors are friendly with you and they don't file a complaint, nothing happens. And in some cases, somebody will complain 15 years downrange after the tower went up, and then the zoning board says, how come this didn't bother you during the first 14 years? So I do recommend you look into the rules and regulations. I do recommend that you try to do it online first, because that way you can do it quasi-anonymously. Worst comes to worst, you may have to go to the zoning board of your particular town and ask for a copy, or ask to see a copy. In some cases, you've got to buy it. In some cases, it costs you $20 for a copy of the zoning law. But I do recommend you find out what are the rules for your particular community, Joe. In general, beyond 35 feet, it is required. And one of the things that's in your favor that I've recently discovered is that everybody looks at a shiny, brand-new radio tower and they consider it to be a hazard. The real world, a tower is 10 to 1 less of a hazard than a good-sized tree. I know because a lot of 85-foot-high trees fell on my property, and I weighed the pieces of trees that I was chopping up, and I found out that a good high oak tree, the middle of the tree, has more pounds per 10 feet by 10 to 1 compared to a Roan 55 tower. That explains why, of all the ham radio pictures I've seen where a ham radio tower fell and it laid across the roof of the house, 99% of the time it didn't damage the roof of the house. Sometimes it would damage a couple of shingles. It didn't penetrate the house. Whereas a tree falling on a house, 50% of the time it will penetrate the house and do damage. And I used to think to myself, boy, these hams are real lucky that they didn't...
Repeater, time out.
I used to think that these hams are real lucky that they didn't get damaged. I suddenly realized that the tower in pounds per 10 foot of length is, in general, 10 to 1 lighter than a tree. A tree is a hell of a lot more destructive. So your neighbors, when they see the tower and they're worried about whether or not it's going to fall and do damage to their property, they don't realize that that tree that's on your property is 10 times more damaging. We amateurs have to make that more clear to zoning boards, that trees, that ham radio towers, which almost never fall like a pencil, they almost always collapse on station, and even if they did lay across the roof of the house, there's almost no evidence of a tree, of a ham radio tower, penetrating the house and doing damage internally or representing a risk to the people inside.
So, as I said, there's a huge educational problem required here. I know you didn't get an exact answer, but I think you know a little bit more about what to look for. I do know if you Google the right words, you'll find quite a few articles on the subject. I know that there is a section of the ARRL website where on zoning law and towers, and they sell individual books on the subject. So if you go to the ARRL, I know you're going to find more information on this one, Joe. KC2QIW, wait for the beeps. K2LIW on the deck mask.
J2 India Zulu, comment.
Oh, okay. Yeah, thank you for the help. Yeah, it's funny that you said that because we did cut down a old tree in the backyard over here. So they helped me cut down the old tree in the back. And there's like 40 foot poles in the back, you know. So so far I'm lucky. No one's complaining about the fan dipole in the back over here. So okay, so that's good to know. And
okay, I heard blank J2 India Zulu. Give me the full call and your name, sir, and your comment. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick John. K2 India Zulu down in Copac. You got a moment for comment because you missed one heck of an important matter in a lot of opinions about putting up a tower at Dick, over.
Fire away, John. Wait for the beeps and give us your information.
You and I have been around long enough, and we used to see Harry Daniels give his little talk of why do amateurs have so many frequencies, and he would spread his arms full width. Why do so many amateurs, you know, he'd hold his fingers, about a quarter of an inch apart, have access to this many frequencies, and he would spread his arms full width? Because we perform a service to the public. Okay? I got a tower up here. My neighbor's got a tower up here to TV, the whole bit. We're sitting at about the 30-35 foot level. But we're also members of the Town of Babylon, ARES, emergency services, the whole bit. Our neighbors know in time of emergency that tower is probably the only communications that's going to be in and out of there. Let me drop it a second. Oh, I mean, I've seen towers up in the air with the great big bird roosts on them. Okay, fine, have a ball. But the thing is, you know, like I say, you say, why am I putting up a tower? Because I want to talk to the world. Or, hey, I'm a member of a local ARES. I've already spoken to the town radio officer. It's needed, and in time of emergency, I'm going to perform, for my station. I've got an emergency generator. I'm going to be on the local repeaters, and I'm going to be doing helping our neighbors in time of an emergency. That tends to shed just a little more favorable light, especially from the neighbors, if they know you're there to help them. It kind of smooths the way. Dick, over.
It sure does. Now, when you listen to this particular repeater, during the next month or two after Super Hurricanes Sandy, you heard tremendous amounts of information being sent back and forth as to where to go to live, what grief people are suffering, how many people lost power, how many people bought motor generator sets, how many kilowatts a motor generator set is appropriate, and just being big enough is not the right answer. Because if it's big enough that you run everything and you live in the lamp of luxury, you're going to be on a gas line with a whole bunch of other people trying to get gas to run the generator, and trying to get fuel out of your automobile is a problem. So yes, we amateurs provide one hell of a good service for emergencies, for giving information to each other, and helping our neighbors and helping each other. That's a big factor. And as such, a smart community would not do things to put amateurs at a disadvantage. Huntington Town, for instance, had some extremely strict rules about radio towers 40 years ago when I first moved in, and they drastically relaxed those radio tower restrictions. They realized after Hurricane Gloria, for instance, when they realized that my tower
was used to supply emergency communication to the town hall of Huntington, because they were without power, they were without communication of any kind, other than the radio operator in the town hall at the time, talking through my tower to other emergency services, and literally passing information as to which telephone poles that with live high voltage wiring was laying across what major street, where people were driving around and walking and whatever. That kind of information was being passed through my tower during the Hurricane Gloria incident of 1985. And all of a sudden the town came to a brand new respect for ham radio operators. I'd like to believe that that was the incident time in which Huntington Town said, hey, we've been oppressing these people, and they're not bad people with horns. They are a good servant of the community, and we should encourage them as opposed to discouraging them. So, as you can tell, the attitude is slowly changing in our favor, Joe, and as such, keep your ear to the ground, talk to your friends on the subject, and I can tell you from personal experience of both John and his buddy Bob and me, once you do put up a radio tower, let me drop. Once you do put up a radio tower and properly support it, it will give you a lot more fun in ham radio. VHF-wise, you'll talk a lot greater range. HF-wise, you'll talk to a lot more people. As long as you obey certain safety rules, you'll be a lot happier, in my opinion. You'll be more committed to the hobby. I do a lot of bragging about this 100-foot tower that's in my backyard, Rhone 55, a beautiful structure. I take pictures of it from time to time and flash those pictures to people. And so you go to QIZ.com and you look up quite a few of these guys' call letters. Very frequently you'll see a picture of their radio tower in their backyard. It's something they're proud of. And so keep going in that direction, John. I think it's worth it. Paul was the next person who signed in with a question. WS2N, K2RIW. Go right ahead, Paul.
NY2HF for a comment.
Do I have anything? Okay, Dennis wants to make a comment first. Go ahead, Dennis. And out there in Kutcherog, I suspect that you're a tower owner, and I bet you very much appreciate it, Dennis. NY2HF for the comment, K2RIW.
Thank you, Dick. Actually, my question that comes, I believe, after Paul, is going to involve a tower. But what I wanted to say was some municipalities are more pro-amateur radio than others. I recently came upon 12 Lifeline HD, I think it's GLP or GDL, batteries at the landfill, and I said this would really be great for the Conic Amateur Radio Club backup. So the manager of the landfill couldn't sign off on them, but the supervisor of the town, Scott Russell, signed off on them. He said, yeah, let them have them. And these batteries were all 12.7, 12.4, 12.5. They go for $850 each. And, you know, it's a godsend. So I distributed some of them. And we're going to be starting a station for the club. And we're going to probably put four of them in for emergency backups. But I just wanted to say, some of this talent is really good. Others not so much. We're kind of blessed with somebody who appreciates doing their emergency broadcasting when they can't do it. Back to that.
Very fine, Dennis. Glad to hear that out there in your community of Kutcherog, which I think is I think it's the Southhold Township, or the Orient Point Township. I think it's Southhold. Glad to hear that they're thinking very positive about ham radio and supporting them and signing off on these very valuable batteries that they've donated to your local ham group. Paul, WS2N, K2RIW. Paul's also our space expert, but he's got another real question tonight. Go right ahead, Paul.
Yeah, this is a bothering question, Dick. I have been bothering some years, you know, like a lot of guys. And in the earlier years, I always went with the soldering gun. You know, I have a Craftsman, you know, with two different settings, 150 and 230. And for many years trying to solder these wires together, it would heat up and eventually I would get it. But you know, ever since I've used the 45 watt regular pinpoint type of soldering iron, you know, it's only 45 watts, but it's got a point to it. And I've been using this for, let's say, the last 5-10 years. I'm thinking about it now. That thing works good. I mean, I could do like a 12 gauge wire, two wires together, solder them together. It takes a little while, but it really does good. With the soldering gun, it doesn't work. It's got like almost like a chisel point on it. And it's Craftsman. I looked around. I don't see any really pointy things. Am I missing something, Dick? Why am I doing better with a 45 watt pointy, just plug it in and, you know, got a little stand to it over the soldering gun? Back to you, Dick.
Like you, Eric, when it comes to soldering, I use three different methods. I do own a soldering gun. I own a soldering iron. I also own the soldering tip for a Burns-O-Matic torch. And depending on where I'm doing the work, I use one over the other. One of the biggest variables with a soldering gun is how good is the contact forming on those two 7/16 nuts that you tighten to put the soldering tip into the soldering gun. The way the soldering gun works is that it really is a step-down transformer. The primary is 120 volts. The secondary voltage is probably something in the vicinity of 3 or 4 tenths of a volt at something like 250 amperes. I'm not sure maybe it's a 500 amperes. It's a huge amount of amperes. A very small voltage is a secondary voltage on that soldering tip. As such, how well cleaned are the actual contacts before you tighten down those 7/16 bolts can make a huge difference. What you think is a 230-watt gun, when you squeeze the trigger all the way, let me drop. If because your particular soldering tip and the way it's bolted down into the tip of the soldering gun, because of the contact it's making today, you think you've got 230 watts there, you might have 20 watts there only, because you're making a high resistance contact. You can tell by the sound of the hum the machine makes. When you're making extremely good contact to that tip, you get a much louder hum. There are various ways that you can measure the strength of the magnetic field it creates. That soldering gun, by the way, when it's making real good contact, you wave that across something that you want to demagnetize. It's making a huge magnetic field that will demagnetize it when it's making good contact. And when it's making good contact, it heats up real fast, and you do get the 230 watts. So there, I think, is the biggest variable. Paul, if you do some experimenting with cleaning up the contacts and tightening it down some more, I think you're going to find a huge difference in how much heat you get and how fast it heats up. Other than that, the 45-watt iron shouldn't be that much better than a 230-watt gun, if you know what I mean. WS2N, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Okay, I'll try that. I'll take it apart. I mean, I've cranked down on that, making sure it's tight. But, you know, I'm going to take it apart, clean them, and put them back in, see if I do any better. But you would think that they would make the same tips, except, you know, with a point. You know, they got this chisel thing on the end. I would think with a point, you're going to concentrate the heat more to one spot instead of spreading it out over, maybe an eighth of an inch or even a little bit larger, you know, maybe 3/16. To have a wide, pointy tip really doesn't make sense. I know there's other applications for it, you know, besides soldering. But you would think they would come with it, or maybe even as an accessory, some kind of a point on it, because that's the other problem. You want to get into a tight spot, and you want to put a lot of heat on there real quick, get in and out. And you can't. So, yeah, I'm doing good with the 45-watt one. stories with these guns. Back to you, Dick.
It does take a lot of care because you're looking for a milliohm of resistance on that soldering tip, and I'm not kidding. You want it to be a milliohm or less, rough number. And so it takes some physical care to make that happen. Also, from time to time, I have filed down the tip of a soldering gun to various shapes that suited my purpose. On a couple of occasions, I've taken a piece of 14-gauge wire, wrapped it around the tip in just the right way, and then the 14-gauge piece of wire, I made a sharp point on it when I had to get into a very small location because I didn't have a fine enough soldering iron. So I managed to use a soldering gun in a very precise manner, but the tip has to be making extremely good milliohm contacts in order for all of that to work. Good luck with that, and let us know what you find out, Paul. The next person who signed in was Arlen. Kilo Alpha 7, Zulu Alpha Uniform. Go right ahead, Arlen. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick. I'll give one more call. Maybe he got timed out, unfortunately. Kilo Alpha 7, Zulu Alpha Uniform in Nevada. K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Arlen, if you're there.
I think his name was Landstick.
Oh, I'm looking at him on QRZ.com. His first name is A-R-L-A-N. I would pronounce it Arlen. Okay, yeah, maybe he got timed out. We'll go over to Dennis and then give Arlen another try later. And then Lance was the next person who signed in from Nevada. Kilo Foxtrot 7, Victor November Hotel. That was the second person who signed in from Nevada. Okay, Dennis is next. NY2HF. K2RIW. Go ahead, Dennis, from Cut.
Dick, comment for Paul.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Paul, I just want to let you know, I have several soldering guns that I use, most of them are Wellers, and I make my own tips out of number 10 solid wire copper. It works extremely well. You can shape them any way you want, just as long as you make them approximately the same length as the original Weller tip or your whatever your manufacturer tip is. And you can hammer them flat or twist them. You can have a ball with them. But number 10 copper wire works excellently.
Exactly. Okay. In other words, you just make it long enough, stick one in one side, one on the other side, clamp it down, make it look like the original tip, and you're good to go.
Have you ever used a bigger than 10-gauge, John? Go ahead, John.
That were made by Weller. And they take, I've gotten 8 wire into that, but 10 usually does it, and if you take a little ball peen hammer and flatten it, you can make a cutting tool. A lot of different tips.
That's a darn good suggestion, John. Thank you for that one. Okay, Dennis is next. NY2HF. K2RIW. You got it, Dennis.
Thank you, Nick. Recently I got, my question is, what can I do to, I don't have the base for it, so what can I do, what's going to line up with that mass? I was given it by Audi Neeson AG2B in Greenville, and he's a retired shop teacher. Gold star, as far as I am. He asked for nothing, he just gave it. Because we're sitting in his yard, and I came by, and I took it. He's fantastic. But what I'm trying to find out is, I think the base for this, hopefully a tilting base. So what would work with a Tristos MM35?
Okay, you got to give us as much audio as you can. I copied everything because I'm wearing earphones and I'm listening to the 375 output where you're a lot clearer, Dennis. On the A5 machine, portions of that I know that people had trouble copying. What Dennis has is a Tristos brand name, MM-35 mini mast. I presume it means it's a 35-foot crank down, tilt over mast type tower. And it was given to him by Artie in Greenport, who is a shop teacher. But he did not receive the base. He received everything but the base. So that's a fairly specific thing. Tristo's MM-35 mast with the tilt-over mechanism. What can he use as a substitute? And my first guess, I'm going to pass it over to the net to see if anybody has a suggestion. Let me drop for a second. It is my guess that this is a relatively rare situation, Dennis, and I think you're going to have to become the mechanical engineer who designs the right kind of a piece of Schedule 40, 2.5-inch diameter galvanized pipe or something like that, where you're going to have to go into your plumbing store, your good-sized plumbing supply house, and look at what they've got and figure out what you can make that can mate with it. I used to have a Reynolds distributor, aluminum distributor, a few miles away from my house. And they used to have a very nice warehouse where I'd walk up and down that warehouse and I would look at all of these 12-foot and 24-foot lengths of aluminum tubing at every diameter and every wall thickness and a couple of different alloys. I called it aluminum heaven. Quite a few times I walked up and down there and I said, wow, could I use one of those and one of those? And they would sell it to me. And so aluminum is, unfortunately has become kind of expensive in dollars per pound. I'm a great aluminum enthusiast because it doesn't require much service. But when it comes to sheer strength, the right kind of Schedule 40 or Schedule 80 galvanized pipe has got all the strength in the world. And then by welding on the right kind of a bracket to it so that you can establish a tilting mechanism and then some kind of a winch that cranks that up, it is my guess you're going to have to do that, because even if that product was still being sold and you walked into a store that sold that product and you told them, I want to buy the base independent of the rest of it, I think there's a 95% chance the store would not sell that to you. Even if it went back to the factory, I think they would tell you, you've got to buy the whole thing. We're not going to sell you pieces of it. That's my guess. I'm going to pass it over to the net and see if anyone else has a suggestion for Dennis. But I think it's going to fall back on him for this unusual requirement. Tristo's MM...
Repeater, timeout.
So once again, that model number is Tristo's MM-35 mast. He wants to know how to get the base for that or how to build a base for that. If you've got a suggestion for Dennis, give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the second hand.
Where is he at? He's sick?
Yeah. Dennis lives in Cutchogue. So I hope you're going to tell me, Paul, that the materials available to him in Cutchogue on the North Fork of Long Island are a lot better than they are in Ronkonkoma, where you live. WS2N for any comment. K2RIW. Wait for the beep. You got it, Paul.
This is Blackman and Shapiro out east. Probably Riverhead. Not too far from there. I think that's the nearest one. Blackman and Shapiro. I mean, they sell, like Dick said, heavy-duty stuff. And, of course, Schedule 80 galvanized is really the way to go. Schedule 40 is good, but it depends on what he's going to do with it. I mean, he's going to build a concrete base and get involved with all of that. I don't know. Is he planning on putting the pipe right to the ground? I mean, even galvanize it right out over time, but I mean, that's the way to go. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, as you can tell, Dennis, I think this particular requirement is going to fall back on you and some good mechanical engineering of you and your buddies to buy that very specialized part, even if it exists. I'm not sure the factory is going to sell it to you. And if it doesn't, if the factory that made it no longer exists, that's going to make it even harder. And you're asking somebody to break up the set, so to speak, to give you the base and throw away the rest. So I think you're going to have to do it, Dennis, and it's not going to be easy.